محلها في العراق.
Well, Mr. Hamza, some analysts argue that civilian and independent forces remain the biggest losers in the current system in Iraq. Do you see any realistic pathway for reform or broader political pluralism within the framework of Iraq's current power-sharing structures? And how do Hashd-aligned groups view the demand for political change?
In truth, when we speak today about the so-called change movement in contrast to the popular mobilization forces, we must recall that the phase in which this change movement, in quotation marks, rose and claimed victory in Iraq's previous elections was a phase in which the United States was directly, intensely, and meticulously overseeing the electoral process and political life in Iraq. This was during what was labeled, again in quotation marks, the Tishrin Revolution. There was massive media pumping, enormous funding, and an active role by the U.S. Embassy in organizing these groups, which were marketed as youth-led and reformist. They were given glamorous labels that attracted wide popular segments. There was also political engineering, arranging electoral interests and alliances between these change groups and several well-known factions and political forces on the Iraqi scene, all of which produced the results we saw in the previous elections. But this landscape changed in the current elections. The intensity of American support for these groups decreased significantly, and this represents a major strategic mistake by Washington, by the West more broadly, and by certain Gulf states that sponsored these civil society-styled movements, believed that these groups had already become an established organic component of Iraq's political mosaic. They assumed they no longer needed the same level of funding, guidance, or careful oversight as before. They also assumed that the Sadrist boycott, combined with the heavy mobilization of rival blocs, would create electoral space for the change forces. But the strong Iraqi popular participation overturned all expectations. The biggest and most immediate losers of these elections were the so-called change or sovereign reform groups, the shiny labels we also know very well in Lebanon, because we lived a nearly identical experience. This experiment failed. Its project collapsed under the weight of massive popular participation, and this will undoubtedly affect the political future, both near and long term, of these movements and their figures. This is especially true given that the political discourse and electoral promises of these groups were centered almost entirely on attacking the popular mobilization forces, a key American demand. But the Arab-Iraqi public understood the American priority embedded in these movements, sovereignty versus resistance, that same dichotomy we witness today in Lebanon. This formula collapsed in Iraq. The PMF is a product of Iraq's internal dynamics, shaped by Iraqi priorities and by the imperative of defending Iraq's security, sovereignty, and geography. Meanwhile, those who came to dismantle this model, the figures and groups promoted as symbols of reform and change, were exposed by the Iraqi people. Their foreign and American-aligned agendas quickly became clear, and so the Iraqi public rejected them, stripping away the glossy slogans and seeing the real plan behind the facade.
Definitely. It was more like in the open eyes of the Iraqis that there were not the priorities that they were looking for. They had other priorities than what the American policy wanted in Iraq. I want to thank you very much, Mr. Hamza Khansa, for your contribution to our show. Thank you very much for your time. Ladies and gents, please stay tuned because next we are going to talk about Iraq's post-election crossroads.
This is Midstream, and here is IRIB English Radio. Dear listeners, in this weekly program, Marwa Osman discusses two important issues related to West Asia region with two political analysts. Midstream is with you every Friday on IRIB English Radio.
Iraq's election results have reshaped the country's political center of gravity, giving significant momentum to parties aligned with the Hashd-i-Shaabi and the broader Shia coalition. Today we examine how this new political map could redefine Iraq's relationship with the United States, challenge regional normalization agendas, and influence the strategic balance across West Asia. More details in the following report.
Iraq's recent parliamentary vote has handed a decisive advantage to coalitions tied to Shia political currents, including lists aligned with the Popular Mobilization Forces, or Hashd-i-Shaabi, and now the conversation has shifted from ballots to bargaining. Results of the elections implied that the coalition led by Prime Minister Mohammad Shaya al-Sudani emerged first. though no single group won an outright majority. That balance, a strong showing for pro-Hashid, pro-coordination framework forces alongside established Shia parties, carries immediate consequences for Baghdad's relations with foreign powers. For Washington, the implications are tangible. A growing parliamentary presence for Hashd-linked blocs strengthens political arguments at home for an accelerated redefinition of U.S. forces' footprint in Iraq, a trend that was already underway this year as U.S. forces began a drawdown and redeployment. Washington's concern extends beyond troop posture. Policy analysts warn that formal political gains for Hashd-aligned actors, particularly if codified by new laws that broaden the Popular Mobilization Force's institutional role, would complicate security cooperation, intelligence sharing, and the so-called training partnerships that have anchored U.S. policy in Iraq since 2014. Washington has always noted that legislation strengthening the Popular Mobilization Forces risks blurring lines between what they deem legitimate state forces and armed resistance forces, a development likely to sharpen tensions with U.S. policymakers. Regionally, an empowered Hashid political bloc changes calculations for Zionist Israel and Arab states pursuing normalization. Iraq's national stance has historically been non-recognition of Zionist Israel. An Iraqi parliament and government more heavily influenced by pro-resistance Shia voices will likely resist regional normalization initiatives and could provide rhetoric and political pushback to efforts that Washington and some Arab capitals have promoted. The strategic gap between Baghdad's likely posture and the normalization track is real, and how Baghdad navigates that pivot will shape not only Iraq's future, but the broader strategic map of West Asia.
To discuss this issue with us from Beirut is Dr. Mohammed Hassan Swaidani, strategic studies researcher, a writer for different media platforms, and the author of several studies in the field of international relations. It's a pleasure having you with us, Dr. Swaidani. Now, Western policymakers often frame the rise of the Hashd al-Shaabi-aligned political blocs in Iraq as a threat to the U.S. influence in the country. From your perspective, what fundamental political or historical realities are being overlooked when interpreting these election results solely through a U.S. internal, national security lens?
First of all, let's make clear that, this is how the U.S. reads most of the incidents or events in our region. It mostly takes into condition its own national interests, national security interests, without taking any interest in what the people are going to say. Mm-hmm. So, having a U.S. security lens view over the Iraq elections, really, it overlooks several factors. Number one, that, Iraq has been, for the last two decades, facing war. Everything started with the invasion of Iraq in 2003 till ISIS into the last decade. So there are several problems that the Iraqis faced. And what the Iraqi people have said in the elections that they are giving al-Hashd and the resistance groups credibility because they were the mainly actors that fought against ISIS, and they were the main actors that protected Iraq from Mosul to Baghdad. Mm-hmm. So, first of all, the U.S. is ignoring Iraq's history regarding its own role in occupation 2003, where everything started. And it's also ignoring the fact that al-Hashd al-Shaabi was the one who stood against ISIS and forbid the collapse of Iraq. Also, it's the U.S. is not reading Iraqi history as what people of Iraq want, because it has been proven over the last two decades also that there is a trend in Iraq that is increasing by time, which is the people of Iraq choosing to be not part of the U.S. Israeli axis. So, as a matter of fact, to end this part, it's obvious that the U.S. only cares about its own national security interests, and it always reads the events from this lens, ignoring the historical facts, ignoring that its own military was part of destroying the history of Iraq, part of destroying many countries in the region. So the people in Iraq today have said what they wanted to say. We read history well. We know how the U.S. interferes in our country. We know how the U.S. have been part of the occupation. And that's one of the reasons, one of the main reasons, we do support the resistance groups. We do support the Hashd al-Shaabi parties.
Mm-hmm. It really is interesting to see how the United States of America looks at a fair election in Iraq and says it is a threat to our national security. How come in a world, especially a post-genocide world, this notion is still acceptable?
No, it's not acceptable, of course, for people of our region. You know, today we have two aligned groups in the region. We have a U.S.-centric one and we have a resistance one. Of course, the U.S.-centric one will not speak any word against the U.S., but the resistance ones will speak the truth because, let's remind the people about one thing.
Mm-hmm.
What have let the message of Gaza reach all the world wasn't the U.S.-centric axis in the region. It was the resistance axis in the region, meaning that this resistance axis is the one that writes the narratives today,
mm-hmm.
or that participates in writing the narratives today. Today we have two narratives. We have, of course, the American narrative that what's happening in Iraq is a threat to national security, and we have the resistance narrative, or the people's narrative, not the resistance, the people's narrative, because at the end of the world, it's the people who have gone to the electoral boxes and voted for Hashd al-Shaabi.
Mm-hmm.
We have the people's narrative that this is our sovereign decision. So I think this is an extra example how the U.S. interferes in elections. It doesn't believe in them when the result is not as it wants. And let me just end with one sentence. This is not the first time, and it will not be the last time the U.S. says such words. It will continue to saying such statements in all the elections that don't abide by its own interests. And I think when we have elections in Lebanon, and if the result isn't aligned with what it wants, we will hear much higher voices from the U.S. And this is basically how, or one of the faces, or one of the shapes the U.S. interferes in domestic
mm-hmm.
politics. It doesn't care about how the people feel, how the people believe, about the people's opinion. It
mm-hmm.
only wants to shape the elections based on its own opinions.
Mm-hmm. Well, in Iraq, Dr. Sweden, the U.S. troops were already undergoing reductions, and now you have parliamentary voices calling for a full shift towards sovereign Iraqi security structures. How do you foresee Hashd al-Shaabi's aligned parties shaping Baghdad's future posture on foreign military presence? And what does that mean for the long-term U.S.-Iraqi relations?
You know, we have to also remember what elections means. Elections mainly means that the people's vote for those who believe they express their own opinions regarding foreign policy, regarding domestic policy and everything. Well, let's see how the Hashd al-Shaabi stance regarding the U.S. presence inside of Iraq. It's against it. It's against not only the military bases, but it's also against any technical training role for the U.S. So it doesn't want any role of the U.S. inside of Iraq. And people voted for the parties that support this opinion. And that gives us a message that because the Hashd al-Shaabi parties got a lot of voices inside the elections. So these voices, a very considerable part of the Iraqi people, are totally against the U.S. presence inside of Iraq. And I think this is one of the factors that will lead to more pressure in the parliament. At the end of the road, also to be realistic, Iraq is like any other country. They have parliamentary groups, they have political parties that they will fight inside the parliament to drive the foreign policy decisions or foreign policy acts. And we will have people that are against the U.S. leaving the country, or at least they wanted to stay and have a technical role. But at the end of the road, when Al-Hashd al-Shaabi gets voices and gets parliamentary members inside the parliament, this means that the pressure to get rid of the U.S. inside of Iraq will continue, because this is part of the agenda of Al-Hashd al-Shaabi. So we will have a considerable part of the parliamentary members will continue pressuring towards kicking out the U.S. from Iraq. And that's one of the reasons the U.S. said that, well, this winning is a national security threat for us.
There's something else, Dr. Swaydan, which is the Iraqis generally declining to join regional normalization trends, which has long frustrated U.S. and Israeli entity strategic planners. In less than a minute, given the new electoral gains of pro-Hashd al-Shaabi and pro-sovereignty parties, what political dynamics within Iraq must directly challenge the normalization project in all of West Asia?
Well, first of all, let's remind people also that there is an act inside the Iraqi parliamentary member that criminalizes normalization. So this is also a decision of the Iraqi people as a whole, not only for al-Hashd al-Shaabi, but Iraq's decision regarding normalization is criminalizing it. It's being against it. Number two, well, Iraq not being part of the normalization group, it isn't about Iraq lagging behind, but it's about Iraq playing a role in reshaping the region, meaning that today we really have two axes. We couldn't have spoken about two axes if we didn't have countries in the resistance axis, because the U.S.-centric one is very well known for everyone, but the other one, we still have Iran, Iraq, Yemen, Lebanon, so Palestine. So we still have several main countries in the region that are against normalization. And this gives us inclusion. It's not about these countries lagging behind. It's about these countries playing a role in reshaping the geopolitical order in the region, keeping in mind the importance of their geopolitical locations. Because if we see Iraq, it's between Iran, the Levant, the Middle East, the Levant, the Gulf countries. Iran's geopolitical location also is it's between the north and the south, between the east and the west, and Lebanon's geopolitical also location on the Mediterranean. So the axis or the group of countries that are against the normalization, they have a geopolitical weight in the region. And that's why it's not about them lagging behind, but it's them changing or speaking about the shape of the region and choosing how or where these countries want to be in the new geopolitical order in the region.
Thank you very much, Dr. Mohammad Hassan Swaydan, strategic studies researcher, writer for different media platforms, and author for several studies in the field of international relations. A pleasure having you with us to discuss the recent elections in Iraq. Ladies and gents, thank you. Please do follow us to get more updates about the region of West Asia right here on the Mideast Stream. Assalamu alaikum.
The whole world is silent towards oppression, even one voice becomes powerful. IRIB English Radio, the voice of the voiceless. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en.
Insights into the Holy Quran.
Indeed, this Quran guides to what is most upright and gives the good news to the faithful who do righteous deeds, that there is a great reward for them.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم. بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. الحمد لله رب العالمين، ثم الصلاة والسلام على سيدنا محمد وآله الطاهرين. In the name of Allah, the most compassionate, the most merciful. Dear brothers and sisters, welcome to another edition of the program Insights into the Holy Quran. I am Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi with you, and in this edition of the program, we'll have a look at the contents of Surah Al-Ankabut, or Chapter Spider, the 29th chapter of the Holy Quran. Brothers and sisters, we have reached the 33rd verse of Surah Ankabut. So let's listen to the verse, and we will be back with our discussion.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم.
In the name of Allah, the entirely merciful, the especially merciful.
ولما أن جاءت رسلنا لوطا سيء بهم وضاق بهم ذرعا وقالوا لا تخف ولا تحزن إِنَّا مُنَجُّوكَ وَأَهْلَكَ إِلَّا امْرَأَتَكَ كَانَتْ مِنَ الْغَابِرِينَ.
And when our messengers came to Lot, he was distressed for them and felt for them great discomfort. They said, "Fear not, nor grieve. Indeed, we will save you and your family, except your wife. She is to be of those who remain behind."
So, brothers and sisters, as you listen to the verse, and you were with us probably in the previous episodes, we were discussing the story of Prophet Lut. And we said that Prophet Lut insisted to actually inform his people, to invite them to monotheism, to actually make them leave these kinds of indecencies and lewdnesses they had. But he was not successful, actually. So there were some messenger angels from the Almighty Allah that came to Prophet Abraham. They gave him the glad tidings that he is going to be granted actually a son from the side of the Almighty Allah. And they also said that we're sorry that we have to destroy this town. So Prophet Abraham, since he actually wanted his heart to calm down, he asked about the destiny of Prophet Lut, and they responded thereupon that there would be no chastisement for him. Of course, I do have to mention this important point here, that it's not a rule that each and every time the seemingly actually righteous ones are not going to be punished because of the actually unbelievers and the evildoers. No, that's not the point. I mean, there happens, and there has been this actually experience, and we have had this many times throughout the history and the history of the different nations, that the Almighty Allah issued the commandment of chastisement for them, for a whole nation, because only some of them were just doing the wrong things, and they were evildoers. But the rest of those people, although they were not evildoers themselves, but they actually remained silent and did not do anything about it. Not even intrinsically, not even their hearts, they hated the action. Although they didn't actually commit the action themselves, but they actually seemed to be having no problem with what was going on in the society. And that's why they were all chastised altogether. But in this case, the Almighty Allah says that we're not going to actually chastise, and we're not going to punish the family of Prophet Lut, because they have done their best, except his wife. So it is interesting that this verse also continues and says, وَلَمَّا أَنْ جَاءَتْ رُسُولُنَا لُوطًا, and when our messengers came to Lut, سِيءَ بِهِمْ, he was grieved on their account, وَضَاقَ بِهِمْ ذَرْعًا, and distressed for them. وقالوا لا تخف ولا تحزن. But they said, fear not and do not grieve. إِنَّا مُنَجُّوكَ وَأَهْلَكَ إِلَّا مْرَأَتَكَ كَانَتْ مِنَ الْغَابِرِينَ. For verily we shall deliver you and your family except your wife. She shall be of those who stay behind. We'll have a break and we're going to be back. So, brothers and sisters, regarding this 33rd verse, we understand that in a kind of situation, in a kind of society that is polluted and corruption is seen in it, the men of Allah are in straitened circumstances. And even for protecting their own guests and children, they are worried too. The family relation does not save a person. That's what we explicitly understand from this verse, but faith and righteous deeds is the key of deliverance. So that's why the verse says, وَلَمَّا أَنْجَأَتْ رُسُلُنَا لُوطًا سِيءَ بِهِمْ وَضَاقَ بِهِمْ ذَرْعًا. When they came, Prophet Lut was grieved on their account, سِيءَ بِهِمْ وَضَاقَ بِهِمْ ذَرْعًا, and he was distressed for them. So Lut's anxiety was for that he did not know them. They were in the form of some handsome youths, and the arrival of such guests in that polluted environment might become the source of trouble for Prophet Lut, and probably it will be a disrespect before his guests. So that's why he became seriously thoughtful that the reaction of those astray, disgrace, and shameful people, what would their actually reaction be towards these honorable guests? So that is the reason why he was actually worried about them. See, abihim wa dhaqa bihim dhara. He was grieved on their account and distressed for them. This is a rather interesting story that we'll continue to mention and continue to discuss it later on in the next episode. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Don't be saddened by what you see, by all the lies and treachery. Life is cruel, but don't worry. In your heart lies the key to unwind all the secrets. This life we see.
Thank you, dear listeners of IRIB English, for listening to us. If you have any question regarding our programs, feel free to email us at englishradio@irib.ir. Until the next program, take care.
You raise your tired hands toward the sky, and the dark night.
night lights up as you praise God. Your tears rain on your hijab and this cold air is filled with the fragrance of jasmine flower. Come and walk again in our troubled streets and lanes and heal the scars of our city with your sense of heaven. Oh, Father, tonight someone hungry and poor knocks at your door, and you give him your necklace and the only food in your home. You talk to God until the rising of the sun, and you forget yourself while praying for everyone. Come and walk again in our troubled streets and lanes and heal the scars of our city with your sense of heaven. Oh, Father,
Iran is known for its four-season climate and the climatic variety in each of its regions. This time, the lavender fields of North Khorasan province have invited us so that we could discover a part of natural beauties in northeastern Iran.
This is a land of a thousand colors, with a wild and vibrant nature, where kings and poets have been inspired by its beauties throughout the ages. A place where fountains keep the rivers flowing like the never-ending tales of Shahrazad in the 1,000 Nights and a Night.
From some of the most arid deserts in the world, the habitat of the Iranian cheetah, to the greenest forests, pastures, and valleys, North Khorasan has it all. Here at the Baba Aman Forest Park, the combination of rivers, waterfalls, and the umbrella of sycamore trees have all created one of the most popular summer hideouts for the people in the region.
There are a number of forest parks in North Khorasan, and Baba Aman is one of the popular ones. In spring and summer, Baba Aman hosts the largest number of visitors. At first sight, the place resembles an oasis. What greets you here upon your arrival is the cool, gentle breeze that touches your face. The symphony of a flowing river and the terraced ponds in the middle of the park complete this good feeling. But our trip to North Khorasan is not all about nature. In this amazing region of Iran, there is a little town which could be considered unique, at least in Iran and its surrounding countries. The exceptional feature of this place unveils itself after a short drive in the town's only boulevard.
We have come to a little town in northeast Iran, a town with only 12,000 inhabitants. What is interesting about it is that it has more than 170 shops that only sell dried nuts and dried snacks, such as this one, which is called kashk. It's a combination of dried curd and herbs and spices.
Welcome to Faruj, the region's trade hub for dried nuts, trail mixes, and you name it.
One of the things that makes North Khorasan exceptionally beautiful is its untouched natural environment. Many believe that this region could be one of the main destinations for ecotourists in the near future. A few kilometers from the city of Shirvan, a village known as Gelian testifies to this fact.
We head towards a hidden paradise in Iran's northeast. Gelian, also known as Golian, is one of the 365 outstanding tourist villages of Iran. With a population of no more than 700, the inhabitants of this picturesque mountainous area are mainly engaged in farming and animal husbandry. Gelian is situated in a valley. The terraced structure of the village and its adobe buildings, along with very tall trees, are only some of the interesting features of this place. Some people believe that if you're born in Iran and spend an entire lifetime traveling across this country, you still wouldn't be able to see all the beauties of this ancient land. This may be true, but seeing at least a part of beautiful Iran would still be worth it. Amir Mehdi Kazemi for Iran.
The nomads follow a complete natural lifestyle. They are self-sufficient in many things, including many of the things they wear and what they eat, like this fatir bread with a taste of nature.
For us city dwellers, it may be hard to imagine living in conditions like this, but this is how the nomads live. These people are so determined. Life is not a joke around here.
Local sports and games are an inseparable part of every culture. Here in North Khorasan province, there is a type of wrestling which is extremely popular among the people. The locals say that it is one of the most ancient sports in the world. It is a part of every festivity and cultural event. It's known as wrestling with chukhe.
In addition to Iran, wrestling with chukhe is practiced in other countries as well, including Uzbekistan, Kyrgyzstan, and the Russian Republic of Tatarstan. But North Khorasan is known to be the birthplace of the sport. History has it that chukhe wrestling was a yardstick by which a wrestler's power and sense of heroism was put to the test. Chukhe is in fact the name of a vest which the wrestlers put on during the match. It is made of a thick cotton fabric and is considered as one of the most famous handicrafts of North Khorasan. North Khorasan is well known for its exclusive handicrafts, which shape a part of the people's culture in this part of Iran. Nargol Heydarian has been awarded several times for her lifetime achievements in reviving some of the forgotten traditional handicrafts of North Khorasan. Nargol currently holds an Academy of Traditional Handicraft in the city of Shirvan. Her goal is to help pass on her art and knowledge to young artists. Traveling around North Khorasan, is like soaring among the pages of an old storybook in your dreams.
To the people in North Khorasan, preserving cultural identity is of great importance. That's why, regardless of their age and ethnicity, they spare no effort in passing on their heritage to future generations. I'm Amir Mehdi Kazemi, reporting for Iraq.
Choose to think better. Welcome to a better you. IRIB English Radio. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en.
Good day to all of our listeners from around the world. This is Iran Radio broadcasting from Tehran. Nice to have you with us. I'm your presenter for the next hour. We have some interesting facts about the Holy Quran. Let's listen to it. Considered to be a verbal revelation by Allah, that is the actual word of God, the Quran is the holiest book for Muslims. Literally meaning the recitation, the Quran is widely regarded as the finest work in classical Arabic literature. Although the entire holy book plays a significant role in the daily rituals of its followers, the first surah, known as Surah Fatiha, is the most recited of the Holy Quran. The surah, which is consists of 7 verses, is repeated in daily prayers of Muslims and on other occasions. Now we go for the translation of this holy surah. In the name of Allah, the most compassionate, the most merciful, praised be Allah, Lord of two worlds, this world and the hereafter, the beneficent, the merciful, and master of the day of judgment. You alone we do worship, and from you alone we do seek assistance. Guide us to the right path, the path of those to whom you have granted blessings, those who are neither subject to your anger nor have gone astray. We start off this hour's programs with Round the World with Reporters. Listen to fascinating reports from all over the globe as reporters tell us what is happening in their corner of the world. They will be followed by Minbar. The program covers speeches on various subjects by very well-known Islamic scholars and orators. Then it's time for our varied radio productions feature. And our final program this hour is Quran Quest. If you want to know more about the Holy Quran, then this program is definitely for you. Stay with us for the next hour.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Said Pureza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Said Amin Alemi, Kabul.
Shahanabad, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the world with reporters.
The scale of military spending across the 27-member European Union is staggering. On Wednesday, the bloc's executive arm, the European Commission, unveiled a new wave of major defence initiatives.
During the next 10 years, there will be around 6.8 trillion euros spent by member states for defence.
At the same time, more than 93 million EU citizens remain at risk of poverty, roughly 21% of the population. We put these figures to officials at Wednesday's defence briefing.
How do we justify this huge amount of money that we're spending in terms of military?
Of course, every government needs to spend on education, social affairs, everything. You know, the needs are enormous. The trouble is that, you know, if you have, you know, infrastructure attacked, if you have, you know, schools and hospitals attacked like they are right now in Ukraine, all of this doesn't matter if you're not able to defend what you have.
Since 2022, the EU has directed 177 billion euro toward Ukraine, much of it supporting Kiev's military effort. We asked members of the public for their views on military spending versus social investment.
The public support is not there, so I do think we need to strike a better balance and listen a bit better to the population.
It doesn't help either when you mentioned about this corruption, the latest corruption scandal in Ukraine. It kind of, that sways public opinion as well.
No, for sure. Yeah, no, I think that's people start asking questions, and rightly so.
It is very important to focus on the social crisis we're in right now. And so many people are not, like, they don't have their rights looked after, and that should be a primary concern.
If you don't have defense capabilities and if you don't have deterrence, then you cannot really expect to cover any of the other aspects either, because if you don't have the basic safety in the society, then everything else falls wayside as well.
As the Commission pushes ahead with its plans for record military spending, the political risk is unmistakable. Many analysts say if citizens judge their leaders are prioritising arms manufacturers over the basic needs of ordinary people, it will certainly fuel a rise in anti-EU sentiment, the kind that will not only threaten this strategy, but the very future of the bloc itself. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
The Israeli violations against Lebanon have intensified, with IOF targeting different villages across South Lebanon, striking multiple buildings. This direct assault on residential areas follows an Israeli drone strike on a vehicle in the town of At-Tiri, killing one person and injuring 11. Earlier, the Ain al-Halwi Palestinian refugee camp near Saidun witnessed a massacre. An Israeli strike hit a mini football stadium, claiming the lives of at least 14 people.
It is a message of intimidation to our Palestinian people in the Palestinian camps meant to produce political outcomes. It is one of many forms of pressure that our Palestinian people are being subjected to.
This ongoing bloodshed, driven by relentless assaults, signifies a dangerous escalation in the regime's unyielding campaign against the Arab nation. Hezbollah condemned the massacre at Ain al-Halwi as a blatant violation of Lebanon's sovereignty. The Lebanese resistance cautioned that any tolerance or weak response would only embolden the enemy, calling for a strong and unified approach to confront and deter the aggression. Hezbollah's Secretary General Sheikh Naim Qasem has said what Lebanon faces is not a failure to implement the ceasefire, but an aggression.
The events occurring today in Lebanon do not represent a mere failure to implement a ceasefire agreement. Instead, they signify a blatant act of aggression aimed at seizing control of Lebanon and stripping it of all forms of strength, military, economic, and political. Their objective is to take control of Lebanon.
Sheikh Qasem directly addressed the government, urging it to reject external pressures, and highlighted that this is a time of steadfastness. According to the United Nations Interim Force in Lebanon, the Israeli regime has committed over 7,300 violations of Lebanese airspace and conducted 2,400 military operations inside Lebanon since the start of ceasefire in last November. In the face of an enemy that apparently understands only the language of force, a harsh truth becomes evident throughout Lebanon. The arms in the hands of Hezbollah are no longer a matter of political debate. They now represent the country's ultimate and singular deterrent against the Israeli aspirations.
For months, two Kerem's neighborhoods have been bulldozed, sealed, and emptied during repeated Israeli raids that have turned entire residential blocks into rubble. As the world remains silent, hundreds of displaced families say they have been left to endure their trauma alone, living between relatives' homes, UN shelters, or temporary structures with no certainty of what comes next.
Nur Sham's camp has suffered greatly, and it continues to suffer. The camp has been emptied of all forms of life. We are expressing our rejection of this enemy's policies. This is a stance of refusal, not a plea for mercy from the occupier.
As Duja speaks, her voice steady but heavy with exhaustion, the sound of live fire cracks through the air above us, a stark reminder that even simple interview unfolds under danger.
As much as we are filled with pain over the camp's condition, we are equally proud of it. We are steadfast. If we were not causing the enemy pain, it wouldn't commit all this brutality against us.
New Shams residents say that the same brutality crushing Gaza is echoed here in the West Bank, where nearly a year of displacement have pushed families into tents and overcrowded apartments. Yet even under fire, they remain strong, insisting the world must not ignore their struggle.
Today, as you saw, we came for a peaceful stand, completely harmless. Yet the Israeli military opened fire. We pose no threat. Our situation is catastrophic. We are dying outside our camps and homes. Some people are living in mountains, tents, or paying extremely high rents. We want to return to our homes. Even if only one room remains, we want to go back.
For the people of Nur Shams, return is not a political slogan. It is a survival. After nearly a year of forced expulsion, their message remains the same. They will endure the danger, but refuse to surrender the place they call home. Standing here among the crowds in Nur Shams, you feel the exhaustion, but also the determination. Families who have lost everything are gathered shoulder to shoulder, insisting on a simple right to return to their homes they were forced to leave. Naqa Hamid, Tul Kerem, Occupied West Bank.
In May and June of this year, Israeli actress Gal Gadot was in the British capital London to film her latest Hollywood movie. Seven pro-Palestine activists caught wind of the location of the film shoot and proceeded to loudly protest outside the site on numerous days, successfully disrupting the filming and imposing large costs on the production of the movie. Gadot, a former member of the Israeli military who took part in the 2006 aggression against Lebanon, is now a Hollywood actress using her platform to advance pro-genocide propaganda on behalf of the regime.
The seven activists were summoned to Westminster Magistrates Court last month. They faced charges of harassment and wrongfully and unlawfully obstructing access to a workplace after pressure was exerted on authorities by pro-Israel lobbyists in the UK. But on the eve of a major hearing on Tuesday, the accused had all charges dropped, with security forces saying that they would receive no further action.
The outcome represents a major victory for the activists, dubbed the Gal Gadot Seven, who in recent months have been facing heavy pressure from the British state, which critics say is acting on behalf of the Zionist lobby in the UK.
I think it's really important to stand up to these Zionist intimidation tactics to show them that A, it won't work, and B, you know, we always have to remember what we're doing this for. You know, we're doing this for the Palestinians, and, you know, it's a very small ask of me, for example, to forfeit 5% of my privilege so that a whole people don't have to lose everything.
The initial court hearing was adjourned due to Jewish extremists attempting to sit in the court's public gallery in order to learn of the activists' home addresses. Sadly for the extremists, they've been deprived yet again of an opportunity to gain key intelligence that would enable them to step up the campaign of intimidation against pro-Palestinian organizers that they're waging in collaboration with the British state.
They're doing this to discourage us, to showcase where they're failing as a state in Britain and across the world, because we are showcasing their flaws, and what we are doing is only right because we are showcasing the truth, because you can't hide it forever.
Critics have pointed to Gadot's wooden performances on the big screen, raising questions about nepotism and whether she's only been given high-profile acting roles in order to promote propaganda on behalf of the genocidal Israeli regime. In this case, The activists not only disrupted the film shoot, but also successfully beat the trumped-up criminal charges they were faced with. Issa Kadhimi, London.
An article published on Tuesday by the Italian daily Il Manifesto exposed a scheme through which Israel has been cleansing Palestinians out of war-ravaged Gaza for months. The article, titled One Way Trip, describes how Palestinians have been illegally evacuated from the Strip through flights organized by a shadowy NGO that goes under the name of Al-Majd Europe. They were taken by bus from southern Gaza's Rafah to the Karim Abu Salem crossing, where they were checked, then transferred to the Israeli regime's Air Force base of Ramon in the Negev desert, without Israeli authorities stamping their travel documents. On Tuesday, Press TV reached the author of the article for more information.
Generally, the Gazans themselves try to contact somebody who helps them leave the localities left in ruins. Strangely enough, this time they are contacted from private numbers by people who have the Gazans' phone numbers. Also, the people who contact the Gazans change every time, and this is very unusual. We checked Al-Majd Europe website, and it appears to be very suspicious. The organization is not based in Germany, as stated by some media agencies.
It is impossible to know how many Palestinians have been deported or illegally evacuated so far. What we know is that tens of Palestinian families have boarded these planes provided by the shadowy Al-Majd Europe organization without knowing their final destination. They paid $1,500 to $5,000 each, the price for children, the same as adults. All flights carrying Palestinians taking off from the Israeli Air Force base had African and Asian countries as destinations. One of them reportedly went through Budapest in Hungary, a EU member state, last summer.
No official record of these trips must remain. Palestinians are told not to talk about these trips with anybody. There is no international control on these transfers. The UN and the UNRWA are completely kept in the dark. And the fact that not even the European Union did some background checks on these trips when one of the flights stopped over in Budapest should be a matter of concern for all of us Europeans. It could be our turn to be treated the same way in the future.
An Italian lawmaker has opted to take some action against what appears to be a fraudulent scheme.
I will file a parliamentary question on these evacuations that look very much like ethnic cleansing or deportations. Gazans don't even know where they are taken, and there are many doubts on the organization that is commissioned to run this marquee activity.
A flight carrying 153 Palestinians from the Strip arrived in South Africa on Thursday. The South Africa Foreign Ministry called the flight a part of a clear agenda to cleanse Palestinians out of Gaza and the West Bank. Max Civili, Rome.
The relationship between the United States and Saudi Arabia continues to embarrass and undermine claims that Washington actually cares about human rights. United States President Donald Trump rolled out the red carpet for Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman for the first time in 8 years, ever since he became an international pariah for the gruesome murder of Washington Post journalist Jamal Khashoggi. When asked about Khashoggi, Trump stunningly defended bin Salman.
You're mentioning somebody that was extremely controversial. A lot of people didn't like that gentleman that you're talking about. Whether you like him or didn't like him, things happen. But he knew nothing about it, and we can leave it at that.
Khashoggi's murder highlighted a number of reactionary ideas: pro-monarchism, anti-free press, an overly powerful executive, use of invasive Israeli tracking spyware, state impunity, ignoring human rights abuses for domestic and personal gain, and more.
Yeah, it just shows the hypocrisy of the United States. You know, we talk a big game about freedom of speech, but, you know, we support people who kill journalists, and nowhere is that more obvious than in Gaza, where hundreds of journalists have been killed.
Trump and bin Salman have had weeks of talks about normalizing relations with Israel, which Riyadh appeared on the verge of doing until the start